Chapter 4. Special Forces. In 1953, Billy Waugh was transferred to a U.S. military base in Augsburg, Germany. Before he left, he saved up his army money and bought himself a car, a sharp-looking 1949 Chevrolet four-door sedan. It was his first car and he adored it. When he received orders to travel to Germany, he arranged to have it shipped across the Atlantic so he could drive it around on the Autobahn. A few weeks after he arrived in country, his Chevy arrived. The army notified him to say that his automobile was in the port city of Bremerhaven, 475 miles away. On the train ride there, he noticed two U.S. Army sergeants wearing unusual patches with a parachute and aircraft on their shoulders. "Why are you wearing that patch?" Waugh asked. The men said that they were part of a new outfit in Bad Tölz. "Where the hell is Bad Tölz?" he asked. They said that it was about 80 miles southeast of the U.S. military base in Augsburg. "What do you do there?" Waugh asked. They couldn't tell him, they said. Now they really had Waugh's attention. "Do you have any vacancies?" Waugh asked. "We need MOS triple ones," one of the men said. "Platoon sergeants." Waugh pointed to his own shoulder, to a combat infantry badge indicating that he was MOS 111 eligible. The mysterious men gave him contact information. "I got my car, hightailed it back to Augsburg, and asked for a 1049 request for transfer. Within a week, I was transferred, badge and baggage, to Bad Tölz. I signed in at headquarters, went straight to the snack bar, and introduced myself to the six guys who were there," remembers Waugh. "Welcome to the 10th Special Forces," one of them said. The group was a classified U.S. Army program that trained soldiers for unconventional warfare. The first of its kind. Just 4 months old, it had been named the 10th Special Forces so as to deceive the Soviets into thinking there were 9 other Special Forces units ready to engage in sabotage, subversion, and other forms of guerrilla warfare. Waugh remembers feeling awestruck. "I'd found my true home." If the U.S. Army went into the Korean War with no formal special operations capabilities, it came out with a plan for an unconventional warfare unit for use in future wars. Outraged over its stalemate with the CIA regarding who controlled covert operations in Korea, General McClure went directly to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, determined to create for the Army a special forces capability like no other in the world. "But to achieve success," said McClure, "the organization should start modest and austere." McClure knew that unconventional warfare was frowned upon by most generals in the Defense Department. He didn't want to jeopardize the potential for success. In its simplest terms, the Army's vision for unconventional warfare was to support resistance movements in foreign lands, local guerrilla forces that shared America's pro-Western, anti-communist goals. Any resistance movement that the U.S. Army would engage with would likely already be militarized and semi-organized. But to say that unconventional warfare could ever be defined in simple terms was wishful thinking. Resistance movements were notoriously turbulent, almost always led by charismatic leaders with big personalities, some noble, others corrupt. For the U.S. Army to find success in training and equipping these foreign fighters, its special forces operators would have to be flexible, patient, and extremely disciplined. They'd have to be self-reliant, quick-thinking warriors capable of operating in openly hostile territory without the support of conventional military forces close by. In the winter of 1952, General McClure secured the necessary blessing of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The 10th Special Forces Group would be a small and secret unit. Its soldiers would become known as quiet professionals. Finding the right volunteers was a priority. McClure had his adjutant general prepare a roster of ex-OSS officers with commando, ranger, and guerrilla warfare backgrounds. He sent one of his officers to visit with retired General William Donovan at Donovan's law office in New York City. Donovan shared with McClure his personal files, containing the names and addresses of more than 3,900 former soldiers who'd served in the OSS during the war. The Army sent out queries to hundreds of these individuals, some active duty service members, others retired, to see if they were interested in volunteering for the clandestine unit. Volunteers had to be at least 21 years old, airborne qualified or willing to become so, and able to pass a series of physical and psychological tests. Enlisted men accepted into special forces had to commit to training in one or more of 5 specialty areas: operations and intelligence, engineering, weaponry, communications, and medical aid. On June 19, 1952, the Army activated its first unconventional warfare unit at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, consisting of 1 officer, 1 warrant officer, and 7 enlisted men. The group's first commander was OSS Jedburgh Colonel Aaron Bank. By the end of the month, 122 soldiers of all ranks were present for duty. In November of the following year, the 10th Special Forces Group, Airborne, received overseas orders and sailed for Europe. They arrived at Bremerhaven and then traveled by train to Bad Tölz. Their facility was a former Nazi training facility for the Waffen-SS. The group's original mission was to conduct unconventional warfare behind enemy lines in the event of a Soviet invasion of Europe, modeled after what the OSS Jedburghs had accomplished in France. These small 12-man units were called A detachments, or A teams. Each was made up of 2 officers and 10 non-commissioned officers, or NCOs. Every individual on the team had to pass months of training and a series of grueling tests to become Special Forces qualified and wear the Green Beret. Each A-team would be capable of infiltrating a target by air, land, or sea, and exfiltrating stealthily. Each team, led by a captain, had members trained in weapons, demolition and engineering, medical, communications, and operations and intelligence. They would build their own bases, conduct their own perimeter defense, and be able to operate in hostile territory for an indefinite period of time. Everyone on the team was schooled in at least 1 foreign language. The members of this new group called Special Forces prided themselves on being a certain breed of soldier with distinct temperaments and special abilities. Hard-bitten troopers who were willing to take calculated risks and face challenges that conventional units need never be concerned with, said Bank. Men born of an almost inhuman ability to absorb any stressful situation and carry on into battle without letting mental concerns or emotions get in the way. Operators needed to be extremely competitive, self-reliant, stress-resistant, and stoic to the point of arrogant. Major General Edward Partain, an early member of Special Forces, summed it up this way: "In the early 50s, Special Forces groups were not a recognized part of the Army. They were seen as outsiders, great warriors, but they could not live comfortably within the peacetime regimental system. You had people of the sort that you wished you could deep freeze on the last battlefield and thaw out on the next battlefield of the next war. It was a rough group." Billy Waugh recalls Special Forces operators being called snake eaters, miscreants, and rogues by conventional officers in starched shirts. Many of those recruited for special forces in the early 1950s were soldiers who fought in World War II for foreign armies in foreign countries, men like Larry Thorne. Larry Thorne, christened Lauri Torne in Finland, stands out as a special forces legend, fearless, driven, and recklessly daring. He would have been at home with the Greeks who infiltrated Troy inside a wooden horse, said James Goodby, former U.S. ambassador to Finland. The doomed protagonist in the mold of ancient Greek heroes. Thorne began his career as a captain in the Finnish Army Reserves, where he trained Army ski troops. When the Soviet Union invaded Finland in November 1939, Torne served as unit commander. Under arduous conditions and in sub-zero temperatures, Torne and his unit were infiltrated behind enemy lines, where they engaged in hit-and-run operations on skis against Russian troops. The Red Army had more than three times as many soldiers as the Finns, and what should have been clear Russian victories instead went to Torne's unit. In reaction to Thorne's brave, devastating raids behind Soviet lines, the Red Army placed a price on his head, dead or alive, reputedly the only Finnish soldier so singled out for bounty, says his biographer J. Michael Cleverly. For his leadership and bravery, Torne was awarded the Knight of the Mannerheim Cross, the country's highest commendation for valor, and the equivalent of the U.S. Congressional Medal of Honor. Finland's relations with the Soviet Union changed several times during the war, and when the country's leaders turned to Nazi Germany for military aid, Torne traveled to Austria for 7 weeks of training with the Waffen-SS. He returned to Finland as a Finnish officer and was also recognized as a German Untersturmführer. In 1943, he commanded a guerrilla warfare unit called Detachment Torne. This 70-man anti-Soviet strike force was a Finnish Waffen-SS battalion. As its commander, Lauri Torne wore a Nazi uniform and was awarded the Iron Cross. After the war ended, he was arrested and charged with treason. Found guilty and sentenced to 6 years, he was incarcerated in Finland's notorious Turku prison. But the indomitable Lauri Torne escaped from prison three times until he was transferred to Riihimäki prison on a small island north of Helsinki. In December 1948, he was pardoned by Finnish President Juho Paasikivi and released. But when the threat of additional war crimes charges resurfaced, Torne assumed the identity of a Finnish merchant sailor and fled to Venezuela under the alias Eino Morski. From Venezuela, he secured passage on a freighter headed to the United States. Just a few miles out from the shores of Mobile, Alabama, Torne leapt overboard and swam to shore in a classic example of clandestine infiltration into a foreign target. A fugitive in the United States, he made his way to New York City, changed his name to Larry Thorne, and worked as a carpenter in Brooklyn and Connecticut. It did not take long for the consummate warfighter to become restless and bored. In 1951, he sought out William Donovan, the former director of the OSS, and asked for his help joining an American unconventional warfare unit. Donovan schooled Thorne on the newly instated Lodge-Philbin Act, which Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. had been instrumental in getting passed. It allowed foreigners to join the U.S. military and earn citizenship if they served honorably for the United States for at least 5 years. Larry Thorne breezed through U.S. Army basic training and was singled out as a prime candidate for the 10th Special Forces Group. Sent to Bad Tölz, he became an invaluable part of the unit. "Thorn is one of the most devoted and conscientious officers I have known," wrote his commander, "an aggressive officer who is at his best in a situation which demands physical exertion, direct action, and forceful leadership. In addition to his physical prowess and irregular warfare skill set, he spoke English, German, Estonian, Swedish, Norwegian, and of course Finnish." Working alongside Larry Thorne, Billy Waugh was amazed by the soldier's breadth of talent, his discipline, stamina, and confidence. At Bad Tölz, Thorne was participating in a third military command. He'd fought for the Finns, the Nazis, and now the United States. "He was what we call a total oneer," explains Waugh. "Having engaged in clandestine ops for several nations, in just about every environment known to man, he could adapt to stressful situations anywhere in the world. Mostly, he preferred going at it alone." In Bad Tölz, Larry Thorne was made captain and became the quintessential Green Beret. He was exactly what the special forces were looking for in a warfighter. One example of Thorne's skill and prowess involved the successful completion of a perilous mission in Iran. In 1957, a U.S. Army C-130 transport plane filled with classified military equipment crashed somewhere in the mountains of northern Iran, in uncharted territory. The rescue operation called for locating the crash site, getting a team in there, recovering the bodies and the classified equipment, and getting out undetected. Three previously orchestrated attempts had all failed when Captain Larry Thorne volunteered for the job. Thorne parachuted into Iran with a 12-man team of Green Berets. The unit made their way up a 14,000-foot peak, recovered all the bodies and the equipment, then exfiltrated undetected by the Iranians. Bad Tölz was not for everyone, but for the disciplined nonconformists who embraced unconventional warfare, it was home. Countless foreign languages could be heard spoken in the coffee shop and around the team rooms. Besides European languages, French, Polish, Czech, one heard Turkish, Arabic, Urdu, Farsi, and Pashto. The concept of training guerrilla fighters in other countries was at the core of the new U.S. Army Special Forces capability. Partnership with special units of foreign armies was a primary goal. In service of this mission, Special Forces operators trained with teams in Norway, Germany, Spain, Italy, Turkey, Pakistan, Iran, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. A team led by Major Joseph Callahan traveled to Jordan to establish the first airborne school for the Jordanian Army at the behest of King Hussein. A team led by Steve Snowden traveled to Turkey to train what would become known as the Turkish Special Forces. Another group went to Saudi Arabia and trained 350 officers and non-commissioned officers in a guerrilla force supported by King Faisal. Four teams traveled to Iran to train the Iranian Special Forces in mountain warfare. Another team trained Kurdish tribesmen in the mountains of Iran. One team went to Pakistan, where they trained with their special warfare warriors in desert warfare. The 10th Special Forces Group remained a closely guarded secret until 1955, when the New York Times published a cryptic article about the men, describing them as a liberation force designed to fight behind enemy lines. A photograph showed members of the group wearing their green berets, their faces blackened out to keep their identities concealed. The U.S. Army Special Forces began to grow. Hundreds, then thousands of unconventional American warriors volunteered to join this elite group. They worked tirelessly, training and equipping guerrilla fighters around the globe so as to keep the threat of Soviet expansion in check. U.S. Army Special Forces soldiers would eventually fight secret wars alongside many of the foreign fighters they trained. Other times, they would find themselves fighting against them. Chapter 5. Ruin and Rule in Guatemala. On the wild night of June 16, 1954, a charismatic 26-year-old Argentine doctor named Ernesto Che Guevara stood staring out the window of an apartment in Guatemala City, listening to machine gun fire and watching a fighter bomber aircraft fire on civilians below. He sat down to pen a letter to his mother, a wealthy aristocrat whom he adored. He felt a rush watching people die for a cause, he confided to her. Even the light aircraft bombings have their grandeur, the sound of its machine gun and the light machine guns that fired back at it leave me with the magic sensation of vulnerability. At the time, the young doctor had no idea that the jet fighter he observed was being flown by an American-trained mercenary pilot who was part of a covert action operation for the CIA. The moment transformed him, he later said. Like an inciting incident in a Shakespearean tragedy, the attack on Guatemala City catalyzed Che Guevara into action. Many men dream of leading a revolution, but Che Guevara would actually do it. His actions put him directly in the crosshairs of three U.S. presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. He would eventually be assassinated by CIA-trained fighters in the mountains of Bolivia in 1967. Che Guevara had come to Guatemala to study medicine amid social revolution. When he first arrived, the country was in the throes of civil unrest. Guatemala, located just south of Mexico in Central America, had been plagued by violence and social upheaval since 1944, when university professor José Arévalo became the country's first democratically elected president. For the first time in its history, Guatemala got a constitution, an elected representative body, and a Supreme Court, but the violence was constant. President Arévalo survived 25 coup and assassination attempts in his 6 years in office. From the perspective of the White House, political instability of this magnitude made Guatemala a prime target for Soviet meddling. And in 1950, the U.S. State Department sent its top diplomat, George Kennan, to investigate. After touring Latin America, Kennan took a hard-line view that Moscow was indeed making ominous inroads in the Western Hemisphere. Here, as elsewhere, Kennan wrote in a secret report for the Secretary of State, "The inner core of the Soviet communist leadership is fanatical, disciplined, industrious, and armed with a series of organizational techniques which are absolutely first rate." In all likelihood, Kennan warned, Moscow's first conquest in Latin America would be Guatemala, which it could then use as a beachhead to launch a takeover of the Americas. Kennan advised the Secretary of State that communist influence in the Western Hemisphere had to be curtailed at any cost. Diplomacy was unlikely to work, and military intervention was not plausible, he wrote, which left covert action as the third and best option. Now this gets us into dangerous and difficult waters, where we must proceed with utmost caution, advised the man who first proposed that the CIA develop a guerrilla warfare corps. What choice was there? From Albania to Poland, seven governments in Eastern Europe were now being ruled by Stalinists, leaders who'd been emplaced by rigged elections and who maintained power through a devious partnership with Moscow's iron-fisted state security services. Moscow's movement toward Latin America forecast only disaster. Keenan's report was reviewed by the President's National Security Council, whose members unanimously agreed. Covert action was the best way forward. The following year, in March 1951, a liberal Democrat named Jacobo Arbenz, son of a Swiss-German father and a Guatemalan mother, was elected president. In his inaugural address, Arbenz promised to move Guatemala from a backward country with a predominantly feudal economy into a modern capitalist state. The way he intended to do this, he said, was by limiting influence by foreign corporations. Guatemala was a poor nation with an agrarian-based economy. 2% of the population owned 72% of the land. The largest landowner, also one of the country's largest employers, was the American-owned United Fruit Company, a banana farming concern. When President Arbenz instituted sweeping reforms in farm labor and called for the expropriation and redistribution of land, including 234,000 acres owned by United Fruit, President Truman's National Security Council took the position that these anti-American moves were being engineered by Moscow. The time had come for the hidden hand of the United States to intervene. "It is essential to our security that we fight fire with fire," Keenan observed. President Truman created a powerful new advisory committee to determine the desirability and feasibility of covert action operations. Called the Psychological Strategy Board, PSB, it included the Director of Central Intelligence, the Undersecretary of State, and the Deputy Secretary of Defense, with a representative of the Joint Chiefs of Staff acting as principal military advisor. The informal structure of the PSB allowed for problem-solving to occur outside the scope of normal bureaucratic channels, insulating the president from potential backlash through plausible deniability. The working group should shy away from any thought of a charter, which would require formal departmental concurrence, suggested Frank Wisner, then CIA Deputy Director of Plans, in an early staff meeting. An agreement was reached to develop a paper which would be informally accepted by the board as indicating the general lines which we would probably follow. In the case of Wisner, who was simultaneously in charge of JAC operations in Korea, the construct of plausible deniability insulated him personally from consequence, as the historical record makes clear. Whether Wisner was aware of his outsized incompetence during this fateful time, willfully ignorant of it, or mentally ill, remains the subject of debate. What is clear is that the goal of the PSB was not only to devise and plan covert operations, but to manipulate the public's perception of these hidden hand events. "Our job is to influence the minds and wills of other people," board members agreed. "Not as in word warfare, but through paramilitary actions that had real world consequences. We help shape events to include all elements of pressure and persuasion," PSB Director Gordon Gray told the president. The PSB's plan for Guatemala was to stage a coup d'etat against President Arbenz and overthrow him using a CIA-trained guerrilla fighting force. The Office of Policy Coordination was in charge, as in Korea. The man chosen by the CIA to lead the mutiny and be installed as Guatemala's new pro-American president was a former Guatemalan military officer living in exile in Honduras, Carlos Castillo Armas. He was corrupt, right-wing, and militaristic, but the Office of Policy Coordination was willing to work with him because he had a decent-sized guerrilla force loyal to him, fighters who could be trained and equipped by CIA paramilitary officers with relative ease. In January 1952, CIA headquarters began drafting its first known assassination list, a compilation of individuals to eliminate immediately under the agency's Title 50 Covert Action Authority. This list was followed by at least two additional kill lists, one titled Guatemalan Communist Personnel to be disposed of during military operations of Caligaris, the codename for Carlos Castillo Armas, and the other under the heading Selection of Individuals for Disposal by Junta Group. The targets, or disposees, would be neutralized under a construct called executive action. This euphemism, adopted by numerous future U.S. presidents, remains in effect as of 2019. Whether President Truman was made aware of the assassination campaign remains a mystery. But the very next month, the subject of Soviet assassination capabilities was discussed by Gordon Gray in a top-secret report to the president. Throughout the world, Gray wrote, the Kremlin has built up networks of agents who would move at the word of command to carry out an assassination or foment a civil war. A subtle suggestion that the PSB plans for assassination were but a necessary means of fighting fire with fire. Assembling a list of individuals for assassination was a flawed and haphazard process. CIA officers first worked from a 1949 Guatemalan army list of communists, augmented by information from the Directorate of Intelligence as it came in. Memos made public in 1997 show that the list included top-flight communists whom the new government would desire to eliminate immediately in the event of a successful anti-communist coup, but quickly grew to include other Guatemalans. Clandestine service officers were queried to help decide who else should be included on a final list of disposees, with one employee assigned the job of quality control to verify the list and recommend any additions or deletions. The assassination list was sent to Carlos Castillo Armas for input. The illegitimate son of a farmer, Armas had spent much of his life engaged in guerrilla warfare. From 1948 to 1949, he'd served as the director of Guatemala's military academy. By 1952, he'd been involved in two previous coups d'état in Guatemala. He was a wanted man in his own country, and his list of enemies was long. In September 1952, Armas added as many as 58 names to the CIA's assassination list. Things quickly got more complicated. That same month, in the Dominican Republic, the strongman Generalissimo Rafael Trujillo, called the cruelest dictator in the Americas, got word of the CIA's assassination list and wanted in. Trujillo made a deal with Carlos Castillo Armas. In exchange for the killing of four Santo Dominicans at present residing in Guatemala, he offered Armas his material support. Castillo Armas readily agreed, says CIA staff historian Gerald Haynes. In addition to requesting that certain of his enemies be targeted and killed by the CIA, Trujillo offered to send his own assassins to participate in the action, special assassination squads that were already trained. In a declassified agency memorandum, these death squads were referred to as Trujillo's trained pistoleros and as K, presumably for kill, groups. But after considerable debate, says Haynes, the idea was vetoed by the State Department. Still, Armas continued to make side deals of his own, and the CIA learned that Armas intended to make maximum use of the K groups and would dispatch Nicaraguan, Honduran, and Salvadorian soldiers in civilian clothes to infiltrate Guatemala and assassinate unnamed communist leaders loyal to Armas. In Guatemala City, a local asset provided his CIA handler with a hit list with the location of the homes and offices of all targets that had already been drawn up. Haynes says records of what happened next were destroyed or lost. The CIA did not create the Latin American propensity for assassination. Long before the Central Intelligence Agency existed, targeted killing was a well-established political tool throughout the region. These were the rules of the game for authoritarian regimes that ruled by force and corruption, not laws. In 1949, President Arbenz himself had benefited from the assassination of his political rival, Francisco Javier Arana. Arbenz had been one of only six men present when Arana, chief of the country's armed forces, was shot in broad daylight during an altercation on the Puente de la Gloria outside Guatemala City. As president, Arbenz did little to solve the extrajudicial killing he'd personally witnessed. There was no investigation of the murder, and his rival's assassins were never apprehended. As of 2019, the killing remains a mystery. As the CIA worked on its paramilitary operations and assassination plans, the president's Psychological Strategy Board oversaw a robust psychological warfare campaign intended to influence the minds and wills of the people, to wage a nerve war against individuals, according to a declassified memo. The idea was to instill fear and paranoia in a core group of military officials close to Arbenz, so they might become turncoats and participate in a mass defection of the Guatemalan army. As the plans moved forward, the U.S. presidency changed hands. In January 1953, Dwight D. Eisenhower became the 34th President of the United States, and the PSB briefed the new Commander-in-Chief on its covert action operations. Cold War concerns convinced President Eisenhower to order the removal of the democratically elected leader by force, according to Haynes. Starting on April 13, 1953, top Guatemalan communists received death notice cards, some for as many as 30 consecutive days, the contents of which remain classified. Others received physical objects courtesy of the CIA, including small wooden coffins, hangman's nooses, and toy bombs. Communist leaders came home from work or woke up in the morning to find graffiti painted on the exterior walls of their homes. "Here lives a spy," one message read. Another threatened, "You have only 5 days." The operation was gaining momentum. Declassified documents illustrate how quickly CIA officials at the highest level got on board with more advanced assassination or liquidation plans. J.C. King, CIA chief of the Western Hemisphere Division, learned of the hit list and on August 28, 1953, suggested possibly assassinating key Guatemalan military officers if they refused to be converted to the rebel cause. The following month, King sent a memo to CIA Director Alan Dulles stating his support for neutralizing President Arbenz. To the CIA, assassination was an objective, an action to be carried out with the precision and detachment of a military operation. It was during this period that the CIA assembled its first known how-to instruction booklet on assassination as an instrument of foreign policy, as a political tool. An extreme measure not normally used in clandestine operations. Titled A Study of Assassination, the manual was organized into sections including planning, techniques, and classifications. The ideal assassin worked alone, always mindful of the fact that no assassination instructions should ever be written or recorded. He or she would almost always report to just one person, with this same individual overseeing their infiltration to and exfiltration from the target area. In addition to having all the qualities of a clandestine service agent, an assassin would have to be determined, courageous, intelligent, resourceful, and physically active. Knowledge of a variety of weapons, including knives, firearms, grenades, and small bombs, was imperative for success. It is possible to kill a man with the bare hands, but very few are skilled enough to do it well, the CIA posited. A human being may be killed in many ways, but sureness is often overlooked by those who may be emotionally unstrung by the seriousness of the act they intend to commit. In a section entitled Justification, the CIA warned its would-be assassins of the dark psychological territory into which they would be heading. Murder is not morally justifiable, and assassination can seldom be employed with a clear conscience. Persons who are morally squeamish should not attempt it. The unvarnished truth about assassination was that while some operations involved the objective detachment of a sniper rifle, a pistol, or a lethal dose of poison, an assassin must always be ready to kill his target mano a mano. For that, he had to be willing to make use of any real-world object that might be lying around. Anything hard, heavy, and handy will suffice, counseled the CIA. A hammer or axe, fire poker or lampstand. Pushing a target off a bridge, down an elevator shaft, or out an open window was a wise course of action. The assassin could play horrified witness if questioned by police. Staged car accidents were not recommended because a lengthy investigation almost always ensued. But if an assassin could drug his target and push the man and his vehicle off a high point or into deep water, the tactic could be considered. If the target was an alcoholic, getting the man drunk and injecting him with a lethal dose of morphine before he passed out was always a viable option. Avoid explosives and demolition charges, assassins were told. They were unreliable and prone to accidents. Often, when used as a booby trap with a time delay, these kinds of devices wound up killing the wrong man. Most of all, the assassin had to accept that he was not judge, jury, or hangman. Assassination of persons responsible for atrocities or reprisals may be regarded as just punishment, the authors forewarned. But to think of it as retribution for an offense was not what covert action was about. To kill a specific individual under Title 50 authority of the U.S. Code was about prevention, not revenge. Killing a political leader whose burgeoning career is a clear and present danger to the cause of freedom may be held necessary, the authors of the CIA's assassination manual made clear. On September 11, 1953, the CIA submitted its General Plan of Action for Guatemala, codenamed Operation Success, PB Success. President Eisenhower signed off on the operation, approving a $2.7 million budget for psychological warfare and political action, as well as subversion, to be conducted by the CIA. On December 23, 1953, the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination opened a classified forward operating base in Miami, Florida, where covert operations in Guatemala would be run. All elements of covert action had code names, people, places, operations, and locations. The PB Success headquarters building, codenamed Lincoln, was located about 10 miles from Miami on the second floor of a shabby two-story structure in the corner of Opa-locka Airport, only ever to be referred to as Building 67. Effective this date, all addressee stations will constitute component elements of PB Success Regional Command, with project headquarters at Lincoln under Jerome Dunbar, Alan Dulles wrote. Jerome Dunbar was the code name for retired Colonel Albert Haney, former CIA station chief in Seoul. Haney, Frank Wisner, and Hans Toft had run the ill-fated Jack missions in Korea. The CIA reached an agreement with rebel groups in Honduras, Nicaragua, and El Salvador to train and equip its guerrilla fighting forces inside these neighboring countries' borders. In these secret paramilitary training camps deep in the jungle, the CIA trained and armed local commandos to act as the fighting brigade for Castillo Armas. Come D-Day, this paramilitary army of foreign fighters would make an amphibious beach landing and carry out the CIA's coup d'état in the style of the Normandy invasion. Declassified documents reveal that at least 1,725 foreign fighters were trained by the CIA, with another 2,500 persons of lesser caliber and faith committed to joining the fighting force if called upon. On January 5, 1954, Albert Haney requested a final list on the liquidation of personnel. The following week, Lincoln requisitioned 20 suppressors for 20 .22 caliber rifles, which were sent from CIA headquarters. A small group of key leaders were then chosen for the assassination program. On January 13th, cables were sent discussing training protocols for these assassination specialists. On April 17, 1954, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, the CIA director's brother, gave PB Success the full green light. The following month, perhaps sensing his end was near, President Arbenz offered to meet with President Eisenhower to reduce tensions between the two countries. But it was too late. The CIA coup d'état was in motion. On June 15, 1954, CIA-trained sabotage teams and invasion forces launched from Honduras, Nicaragua, and El Salvador and moved quickly into staging areas just outside the Guatemalan border. At 5 p.m. on June 18, President Arbenz held a massive rally at the railroad station. The gathering was buzzed by CIA planes. At dusk, Castillo Armas crossed the border with his personal strike force. Overhead, CIA planes strafed Army troop trains. In Washington, D.C., the PSB ordered the Matamoros Fortress in downtown Guatemala City bombed. 100 miles east of the capital, the city of Chiquimula fell to CIA guerrilla forces as an American F-47 flown by a mercenary pilot dropped bombs. Finally, on June 27, 1954, as Castillo Armas attacked the city of Zacapa, President Arbenz capitulated and resigned. By June 30th, the CIA decided that the coup had been a success. Now it was time for the hidden hand of the CIA to vanish. Frank Wisner sent a cable entitled Shift of Gears, urging all CIA officers and operators to withdraw. On July 4th, the CIA dispatched a recovery team to Guatemala City to collect 150,000 documents related to all communist activity for future use. On July 12th, the Lincoln office in Opa-locka was shuttered. Frank Wisner ordered Albert Haney to destroy all documents relating to Operation Success. A few survived. The president asked the CIA to brief him on the operation. Alan Dulles, Frank Wisner, and J.C. King used maps and charts to narrate how the coup had unfolded. The president asked how many men had died. Only one, a briefer lied. Eisenhower shook his head. Incredible, he said. Indeed, it had been incredible, writes CIA historian Nick Kulauther. According to the agency's own records, at least 48 rebel fighters were killed in this action. The CIA's perpetuation of the falsehood that it had been a success gave way to a decades-long CIA myth that the Guatemala operation had been an unblemished triumph. It was often cited as a model, a means of encouraging future presidents to authorize similar covert action operations around the world. On September 1, 1954, Castillo Armas declared himself the new president of Guatemala. Shortly after he took power, a group of junior army cadets, unhappy with the army's capitulation, staged a coup. It was quickly put down, leaving 29 dead and another 91 wounded. Come October, so-called elections were held, but Castillo Armas was the only candidate. As his government was being installed, a second insurgency emerged. This new military junta came down hard on the resistance movement, quashing rebellions with murder and oppression. It left tens of thousands, some historians say as many as 200,000, killed, tortured, maimed, or missing. 3 years later, on July 26, 1957, Armas, the CIA's puppet dictator, was shot in the presidential palace by a member of his own guard. He died instantly. The assassin, Romeo Vasquez Sanchez, fled to another room in the palace and committed suicide. The facts of the CIA's hidden hand operations in Guatemala would remain secret until May of 1997, when the agency's history staff rediscovered the allegedly lost records. Congress had been looking for them since at least 1975, when the Senate began its investigation into U.S. government-sanctioned assassination. 4 years later, in 1979, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit ordered the Guatemala documents be declassified, but the CIA was able to keep its records sealed on national security grounds. As for the assassination programs and kill lists, CIA staff historians continue to insist that no one was actually assassinated. This is a doubtful claim. When the documents were finally declassified, the names of the people targeted for assassination were redacted, making it impossible to discern if any were killed before, during, or after the coup. Extreme secrecy and illicit hiding are but two elements of plausible deniability, designed to keep the office of the president from being embroiled in controversy and disgrace. But there is so much more that results, including grave and unintended consequence the CIA can neither foresee nor control. In its hidden hand operations in Guatemala in 1954, the CIA created a revenge-seeking monster intent on destroying its creator. It took the form of Che Guevara, the young doctor who watched the CIA-led coup through an open window in an apartment in Guatemala City. Shortly after he wrote the letter to his mother, expressing the magical sensation he felt watching violence and revolution unfold, Che Guevara set out onto the city streets to organize a resistance movement against the plotters of the coup. He teamed up with an armed militia organization called the Communist Youth and expressed a desire to fight. Instead, the group's leaders assigned him hospital duty and instructed him to await further orders. Within a few days, martial law was declared across Guatemala, and the Communist Party was disbanded. With its fighters being rounded up, Che Guevara sought refuge in the Argentine embassy. There, he learned that the heart of the Latin American communist movement was moving to Mexico City. He applied for a visa and made his way. It was there that he met a young Cuban-born revolutionary living in exile there, Fidel Castro. He is a young man, intelligent, very sure of himself, and of extraordinary audacity, Che Guevara wrote in his diary. I think there is a mutual sympathy between us. Fidel Castro asked Che Guevara to join his guerrilla movement and serve as the rebel group's official doctor, and he accepted on the spot. In just 5 short years, the two revolutionaries would transform from complete unknowns to two of the highest-ranking enemies of the United States. Back in Guatemala, as the CIA's cleanup group was sorting through files of the fallen Arbenz regime, CIA officer David Atlee Phillips came across a single sheet of paper about the young doctor named Che Guevara and his communist ties. "Should we start a file on this one?" Phillips' assistant asked his boss. "Yes, I guess we better have a file on him," Phillips replied. Soon, the CIA would place Che Guevara on their kill list.